It's Thursday, April 11th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. O.J. Simpson is dead. The juice squeezed all he could out of life, and not just his own. Headline, NBC News. O.J. Simpson dies of cancer at 76 after storied NFL career and notorious murder trial. New York Times. O.J. Simpson, athlete acquitted of murder, dies of cancer at 76. The headlines marking his passing, as you could hear, say it all. Nah, say it some. O.J. Simpson, football player and actor accused of murdering his ex-wife, dies at 76. That from Variety. It's all true. He was accused. He was indicted. He was tried. He was acquitted.
Remember these words. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
And that's where most of the headlines leave it. But you know, they could have said O.J. Simpson, adjudicated killer and former football star, dead. If we say Donald Trump has been adjudicated to have committed sexual assault, and we do say that because it is true, a civil jury in the case of E. Jean Carroll reached the verdict that said so. A civil jury in the case of O.J. Simpson found him liable for killing Ron Goldman. The family of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, out of sensitivity to Nicole and O.J.'s children, who were just then 11 and 7, they would have been named plaintiffs. So they didn't sue OJ for the death of Nicole. They just put in a battery claim. They won that claim for the amount of $12 million. OJ has never paid that, or the Goldman family. But let us not allow the death of OJ Simpson or the deaths he was adjudicated to have caused get in the way of the proper contextual celebration of his life. Let's go to the videotape. Okay, O.J. confronts the gunman, and they shoot him several times. He conks his head, and oh no, it's a hot stove! O.J. puts his hand on the hot stove. This is, he has now conked his shoulder against some wet paint, and not an open window! The hand is in the open window. This is just terrible, terrible for O.J. A cake! Who put a wedding cake out on a ship full of gunmen? Not the bear trap! This can't get any worse for the juice! He's over the boat. And that's about enough of the context that we need. As the Naked Guns officer Nordberg, Simpson gave us laughs. As a Hertz spokesman, he gave us marketing. As a football player, he gave us effort, talent, and records. He won a Heisman Trophy at USC. He claimed the NFL's all-time single-season rushing mark.
Neither sleet nor snow nor the New York Jets could stop O.J. Simpson and the Buffalo Bills, who ran to four records on a freezing afternoon. Three of them were Simpson's. He entered the game needing 61 yards to break Jim Brown's single-season rushing record.
And on this game, he became the first player to pass 2,000 yards in a season, a 14-game season at that, which has never been equaled.
Not just breaking Brown's 10-year-old record, but burying it deep in the snowy ground of Shea Stadium.
Still, his legacy offends and appalls me as a humanitarian, as a believer in justice, and of course as a Jets fan. Clearly, the ghosts of Shea Stadium are still unsettled, as we heard mentioned by Hughes Rudd of CBS News in 1973. O.J. Simpson died of cancer at the age of 76. Ronald Goldman would have been 55, Nicole Brown Simpson, 64. On the show today, UNRWA, an OTM, but first, Chris Malamphy is the chart analyst, pop critic, and host of the Hit Parade podcast. He's the author of the book Old Town Road. No unnecessary subtitles in that one. Old Town Road. Guess what it's about? The song Old Town Road. From time to time, we are graced by Chris's presence. He comes by, we break off a year, and analyze all the number one hits of that year. And that year, this year, today, is 1988. Chris Malamphy up next. Controversial statement upcoming about foodies. You know the best part about being a foodie? It's the food. And you know the worst part? Well, I'm not going to say everything else. The restaurant experience is often really quite good, but so often it's not. Getting the reservation and then cramming into a cramped table and then paying, it's often very expensive. And here's this trend. You know, tile looks cool on the floor often and brick on the wall, but then when you combine that in a crowded restaurant, it is hard to enjoy dinner above the din. What about the cooking? What about the food? Well, I give you Cook Unity. It's the first chef-to-you service that delivers locally sourced meals from award-winning chefs right to your door every week. Choose between 4 and 16 meals. You can just give your life over to Cook Unity, or just pick and choose their delicious meals from award-winning chefs. A chef collective bringing exciting culinary talent straight to your table. It's sometimes hard to find out who are the up-and-coming chefs. Cook Unity has collected many of them, and they give you 7 different dietary preferences: vegan, paleo, pescatarian, gluten-free, and then you can tell them, I don't like soy, I don't like nuts, or can't have them, and you don't have them. They post the menus 2 weeks in advance. It's fun to go and look over the menu. I've been enjoying so many of the meals from Cook Unity. I had a Korean beef dish that was amazing. I had a quinoa and salmon with the string beans that was likewise amazing. Couldn't be easier to make. They don't give it to you frozen. They give it to you in packaging that could last in the fridge up to 7 days. I've tested them on that, and it has worked. It was delicious. So experience chef quality meals every week delivered right to your door. Go to cookunity.com/thegist or enter code thegist before checkout for 50% off your first week. That is 50% off your first week by using the code thegist or going to cookunity.com/thegist. The year 1988 for music changed all of our lives, and not just because of the songs like Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror or George Michael's Father Figure or, yeah, Debbie Gibson was there. Changed our lives because how many times have you been forwarded an urgent email and you won't believe what, boom! Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down. Yeah, Rick Astley. Rick Rowling was born in 1988. A diverse and fascinating year for music. Speaking of diverse and fascinating and unbelievably authoritative, Chris Malamphy is here. He's a columnist for Slate. He's the host of the Hit Parade podcast. And too infrequently these days, he comes around. We take a year. We talk about the number one songs. Let's do it for 1988. Is this the year, what, you graduated high school or took the SATs, Chris?
I think it's the year I took the SATs. First of all, hi, and thanks for having me back. I always enjoy doing these years of hits with you. It's the year I took the SATs. I graduated in 89. So 35 years ago, which kind of blows my mind.
So I have to say, I'll allow for the fact that when you're 16, 17, or 18, that's the music that forms you. But I do have to say, there are some terrible songs on this list, but there are songs that not only me, but my kids and maybe people of an older generation cherish, recognize as some of the great songs ever, or at least some songs that are very important to have in our lives. I don't know. You, first of all, agree, disagree. Maybe we're just steeped in the 1988-ness of it all. But tell us how you want to break down these probably too many hits to talk about in one segment.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Your mileage may vary on which hits you don't like. For example, I am a renowned Bon Jovi hater, and there's at least one Bon Jovi number one hit on this list, Bad Medicine, which I dislike just as much as I dislike anything by Bon Jovi.
It's a little formulaic, yeah.
I don't think even Bon Jovi fans consider Bad Medicine one of his great hits. Their great hits.
No, it's something of an emetic, Bad Medicine, yes.
Exactly. So let's get that over out of the way right off the top.
And you know, is Will to Power's Baby I Love Your Way followed by the Freebird medley? Isn't Freebird doing most of the work in that one?
I don't know. It's kind of 50-50 on that one. What I would say about that number one hit is that it's endemic of a few trends that you see in the hits of 1988. This is a time when radio really controls more than usual what becomes a number one hit. Sales are a component of the Hot 100 at this time, but at this point, the vinyl 45 has faded. The cassette single is just rising. So sales are really kind of a modest or minimal factor. Radio really largely determines what's a hit. And what that means is that radio is looking for reliable radio fodder. And what was doing well in 1988 in particular was ballads. There are a lot of ballads on this list, not just, you know, sort of pathetic, you know, syrupy ballads, but even power ballads of the hair metal variety. We can talk about a couple of those. Also, one interesting trend that you'll note with several of these hits is that there are artists who are famous for their up-tempo tracks that have what I call a belated ballad hit. So, for example, the freestyle Latin pop group Exposé, who'd scored multiple up-tempo clubby hits in the prior couple of years. All bangers, great songs as far as I'm concerned. Point of No Return, Come Go With Me, Let Me Be the One, all up-tempo. They finally score their first and only number one hit with a ballad called Seasons Change.
Ships say
it's a fine ballad as far as it goes, but I would hardly say it's the best example of an Exposé hit. Or, for example, let's take Debbie Gibson. If you ask somebody what's the great Debbie Gibson hit, they'll probably say Only in My Dreams. Or if they were a teenager when I was a teenager, they might say, oh, well, there's Shake Your Love or Out of the Blue. But no, the Debbie Gibson song that brings her to number one finally after several hits is Foolish Beat. And this even applies to hair metal. So, for example, Def Leppard was in the middle of an epic run of hits from their album Hysteria, which came out in the summer of 1987. And each hit from Hysteria climbed a little higher on the charts than the last one. After they, you know, broke into the top 40 with the song Animal, they then went top 10 with the song Hysteria, the title track. They then went to number two. Probably most people think this would have been the number one song by Def Leppard with Pour Some Sugar on Me. It's probably their most legendary hit now.
Yes.
But no, the number one song from Def Leppard, their only pop number one hit, is the power ballad Love Bites. That's the number one hit from Def Leppard in 1988.
Which is weird, because I'm looking at an alternative list that doesn't rank them by number one, but just ranks them by sales. And Pour Some Sugar on Me outsold Love Bites.
Sure, but it's all about timing, and it's, again, about radio. Radio likes a ballad in 1988. You can even point to Richard Marx, who was a singer-songwriter who kind of came up with some help from the Eagles. His early hits kind of sounded like 80s versions of Eagles hits, and even had people like Joe Walsh and Timothy B. Schmidt from the Eagles singing on them or playing on them. Don't Mean Nothing, Shoulda Known Better. These are up-tempo songs, but no. What finally brings Richard Marx to number one for the first time? His ballad, Hold On to the Nights. That's the number one hit in 88.
Hold on to the night.
And Cheap Trick has a lot of up-tempo songs, but they hit number one with The Flame. And Phil Collins does does a redo of Groovy Kind of Love. That's also a ballad. Phil Collins in his solo work is more ballady than he was with Genesis. By the way, did this Groovy Kind of Love, it went to number one. Did the first one by The Mindbenders go to number one?
No, the original went to number two. The Mindbenders did have a number one hit in the 60s called Game of Love. But the original version of Groovy Kind of Love only went to number two. And so Phil Collins took that to number one. And he was promoting a movie at the time. He had an interesting 88 because he was actually acting in a film that he led for the first time called Buster, about a famed British criminal.
It's a Royal Mail train. It carries £1 million on a bank holiday weekend, and we're going to nick it. £1 million.
It didn't do any serious American business. The movie got tepid reviews, but the song, because Phil Collins was in the deep into his 80s imperial phase, the song A Groovy Kind of Love went all the way to number one. And yes, yet again, it's a ballad.
Yes, and so you talked about some hair bands who let down their hair, like Def Leppard. We could put Poison into that category. Every rose has its thorn. Every singer sings a sad, sad song.
I actually, yet again, a ballad.
Yes.
Just like every night has its dawn.
Well, I learned that one on guitar. It's always useful. But then there are a couple of real heavy metal bands that stayed pretty heavy. I'm thinking of Guns N' Roses' Sweet Child of Mine. That, to me, belongs in the category of 1988. What a year. Wouldn't want to live life without that song.
it's probably one of my three or four favorite songs from 1988. And in its way, Sweet Child of Mine is also sort of ballad adjacent.
It does have the portion with the ballady part, yes.
It's a love song, right? So remember that Guns N' Roses took more than a year to break. Appetite for Destruction drops in 1987 and is kind of considered this demonic thing that, you know, MTV is a little afraid to play at first. Their lead single is called Welcome to the Jungle, in which, you know, he talks about the dark underbelly of LA culture. None of this connects with the public. What finally does it for Guns N' Roses is a pure love song, albeit one that rocks really hard and has a killer slash guitar solo. My favorite story, of course, about Sweet Child of Mine is that the main riff of Sweet Child of Mine was never something that Slash intended to put in a song. It was the way he tuned up his guitar. So if you've ever wondered why he plays that strange leaping melody of do-dee-doo-doo-dee-doo-dee-doo, it was just him testing out his guitar. And one day, Axl Rose said, hey, wait a minute, we could actually use that in a song. And sure enough, it became the main riff of one of the most famous hair metal songs of the 1980s.
See, that is when the band was a functioning unit, where one member who hates another member actually gives a good idea. And then they're all jamming at the end, and Axl Rose breaks out with Where Do We Go Now? Which I guess was the question, essentially saying, how do we end it? But it works, and it's classic.
Yeah, I mean, in general, 1988 is kind of near peak hair metal. So between Poison, Bon Jovi and their hair metal phase, Guns N' Roses, you see that hair metal in all its forms is doing especially well on the charts.
Right.
And this will last a couple more years. Bon Jovi will get several more hits in 89. You'll see sort of a second tier of bands like the Skid Rows and the Warrants and the Slaughters score their hits in 89, 90, 91 before, you know, Nirvana comes along and changes everything.
Well,
but
yeah.
88 is still catching hair metal at its peak.
And then after Nirvana comes along, the bands that were hair metal, you know, unfrizz their hair, and Metallica starts wearing more normal clothes, and it doesn't really work, but they try it for a while.
Exactly. But then the other thing I observe in 1988 is that you have several artists that are kind of at an imperial peak. And I'm not just talking about Phil Collins, who scores only one number one hit in 1988. I'm talking about artists that come back again and again and again. Probably the biggest artist of 1988 was surprisingly not Michael Jackson, who scored five number one hits from Bad,
wow,
or Whitney Houston, who scored four number one hits from her Whitney album. It was George Michael, who had the number one song of 1988 right at the beginning of the year with his rockabilly jam Faith.
Well, I guess it would be nice if I could touch your body. I know not everybody has got a body like you, but I gotta think twice.
And then he comes back to number one three more times with the songs Father Figure, One More Try, and Monkey. And each in its way is more imperial than the last.
Well, what do you mean by imperial?
What I mean, imperial is a word that critics and chart analysts like me throw around a lot. It's that phase of an artist's career where kind of anything they touch turns
yes
to gold, and they can kind of do no wrong. And frankly,
so you're saying
songs,
Monkey by itself, as introduced by a theretofore unknown artist, wouldn't have captured the public's imagination?
That's right. Monkey is probably the best example. And I don't say this to insult Monkey. George
no
Michael himself didn't think Monkey was a lock sure hit. He actually took the original album version, which he was never satisfied with. He thought it had good bones, but the production didn't work for him.
A prehensile tail, if you will. Yes,
exactly. He took it to the super producers, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, who that year were just coming off their wave of hits off of Janet Jackson's Control. And he had them remix it and turn Monkey into a total banger. So when a guy like George Michael is going to number one with a song that even he thinks is just, you know, half as good as his earlier hits, you know that he's at the peak of what critics would call an imperial phase.
Okay, I'm going to throw this at you. I want you to rank them or pick the two best of the following grouping.
Okay.
Monkey Wrench by the Foo Fighters, Monkey by George Michael, Shock the Monkey by Peter Gabriel, Monkey Gone to Heaven by the Pixies, or any Last Train to Clarksville by the Monkees. Go ahead. What's your favorite? What's the best?
Oh, God, that's a tough call, because I actually, to varying degrees, love all of those. I might put Shock the Monkey first, but I'm a pretty big Peter Gabriel fan.
Okay, that tells me what is your favorite genre.
Yeah, but a close second might be Monkey Wrench. Even though I'm not that big a Foo Fighters fan, I have long loved Monkey Wrench. I think that's an excellent song. What have we done with innocence? Monkey Gone to Heaven, I love by the Pixies, but it's not my very favorite Pixies song, but I would rank it highly. Then I guess it's probably Last Train to Clarksville, and then finally Monkey by George Michael, even though I'm a huge George Michael fan.
There are quite a few covers on the list. UB40's Red Red Wine's a cover. We talked about Phil Collins being a cover. Was there anything about the interplay between the new and the old that lent itself to covers doing well?
Yes, covers are definitely a trend in 1988. First of all, Red Red Wine. If folks want to hear more about the strange, strange story of how Red Red Wine became a number one hit for UB40 in 1988 in particular, that song was first recorded and released in 1983. And, of course, the original version of Red Red Wine was a Neil Diamond hit in the 1960s and then was turned into a reggae song. Please listen to the pilot episode of my Hit Parade podcast, which came out way back in 2017. Scroll your podcatcher all the way back to the beginning of Hit Parade. I go into great detail about all the improbable things that had to happen for Red Red Wine to become a number one hit in America 5 years after it was first released. So in a way, Red Red Wine is its own bespoke phenomenon. But then, yes, there are several songs that are covers. You already briefly mentioned Will to Power's squashed together cover of two songs, Peter Frampton's Baby I Love Your Way and Lynyrd Skynyrd's Freebird, which they turned into kind of a freestyle ballad. With, you know, sort of synth overtones. That's an improbable one. You talked about Groovy Kind of Love. And then, in a way, you know, you've got more 60s catnip, even though it's not a cover. You've got the Beach Boys, of all people, scoring a number one hit in 1988 with Kokomo.
Right.
Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I wanna take you. Bermuda, Bahama, come on, pretty mama.
Technically not a cover, just like many, many, many other Beach Boy songs.
Sounds like a cover, but is not actually a cover. It was recorded for the movie Cocktail. By the way, the movie Cocktail was a phenomenon in 1988. This shows you how imperial Tom Cruise was, that he can take a terrible movie like Cocktail and make it a box office behemoth with a hit soundtrack that generated two number one hits, Kokomo by the Beach Boys and, wait for it,
here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy.
Don't Worry, Be Happy by Bobby McFerrin was also on the Cocktail soundtrack.
Trouble, but when you worry, you make it double. Don't worry.
Don't Worry, Be Happy was a number one jam, so said Public Enemy. And Chris Melamphy, as you just heard. It's so true. You know who's happy? Pesca Plus members are happy. They'll hear the rest of the conversation with Chris Melamphy. They'll figure out how 1988 winding up on the charts. Let me tell you, there are several more great songs we discuss in detail. Chris, he can't help but providing brilliant insights. Pesca Plus is a great way to get more gist and support the show. Won't you consider membership? No ads, extended cuts of interviews, and happiness and not worry. Go to subscribe.mikepesca.com.
Somebody came and took your bed. Don't worry. Be happy. The landlord say your rent is late.
And now the spiel. UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, is the United Nations agency servicing Palestinian refugees. It is the largest, by far and away, not just aid organization, but any organization operating in Gaza. Only now, it is barely operating, a consequence of Israel's longstanding critiques of the organization, which, Israel says, manifested in an unimaginable breach of basic codes of conduct of anyone operating in the humanitarian space.
The five-page intelligence report accuses four of the UN workers of kidnapping, six of infiltrating Israel, and one of establishing an ops room for Hamas. The UN has not denied the claims, saying it has fired the employees.
The Israeli government published evidence allegedly showing that over a dozen UNRWA members were involved in the October 7th attacks. They shared with reporters a 13-page document alleging that six staffers infiltrated Israel on October 7th and another four kidnapped Israelis. Yoav Gallant, Israel's defense minister, later raised the number of those involved to about 30 UNRWA employees who either killed Israeli civilians, kidnapped soldiers, or helped detain them. UNRWA is a huge organization. It's 13,000 people. They educate Palestinians. They feed Palestinians. It's a necessary organization to the feeding and schooling of the people of Gaza. When there is no war, it is vital. When there is a war, it was a lifeline. But it was also, according to these documents, a host to killers and kidnappers. Here's the Wall Street Journal's description of what the Israeli dossier spelled out. It is the most detailed look yet of the widespread links between UNRWA employees and militants. It offers telling details regarding the events of October 7th. A math teacher belonging to Hamas was close enough to a female hostage in Gaza that he took a picture of her. Another teacher was carrying an anti-tank missile the night before the invasion. One UNRWA employee set up an operations room for Palestinian Islamic Jihad on October 8th, the day after the attack. Three other employees, including another Arabic teacher at an UNRWA school, received a text from Hamas to arm themselves at a staging area close to the border the night before the attacks. After this report and a subsequent one alleging Hamas affinity or Palestinian Islamic Jihad affinity or affiliation, which was loosely defined as about 10 to 12% of overall UNRWA memberships, many Western countries, including the EU and the US, withdrew aid. This past weekend, the National Public Radio program on the media tackled the UNRWA question. They approached the allegations with sheer incredulity, and in doing so, in my opinion, failed to grapple with the truly difficult choice before the world. Do you accept that there was some level of terrorist infiltration in an aid organization, but still find ways to work with the organization to get necessary aid to refugees? Or is that just unworkable? On the media presented another choice, an easier choice if true. Cast doubt on everything Israel says, give voice only to the staunchest defenders of UNRWA, and conclude there's no problem there. That is a much easier choice, if true. The host of these UNRWA segments was Michael Loewinger. He began by talking to Mehul Srivastava, who is a former Jerusalem bureau chief for the Financial Times. He cast doubt on Israel's dossier. Here's an excerpt.
And it had the names of a few people and rather broad allegations against UNRWA at large. But they didn't have any of the supporting evidence.
That's interesting because one of the first articles in the American press about these allegations came from the AP, which referred to, quote, detailed allegations against UNRWA workers. So either the AP had access to something else or they characterized it differently than you are now.
Well, the allegations are detailed. It's the evidence that was scanned in the document that we saw.
But there was detailed evidence to come. Now, if you listen closely, there were moments when Srivastava and the host, Loewinger, didn't dispute that there was more evidence, but there was detailed evidence to come. Now, if you listen closely to this interview, there were moments when Srivastava and Loewinger don't dispute that there was evidence, but they have an odd and I think intentional way of eliding the fact that Israel provided some very solid evidence of at least some UNRWA involvement in the October 7th attacks. Here's how they describe or talk about Israel's strongest evidence. They say that CCTV footage of one person that was described as an UNRWA employee picking up a body from one of the kibbutzes in the south on October 7th. Srivastava then says, "We've looked at the same footage, and I know a lot of other people did, and it did match the kind of behavior and activities we'd seen Hamas militants take part in on October 7th. Yes, the Palestinian man dragging a dead body did match, or perhaps the person wasn't dead then. He was just a potential kidnap victim, but he was being dragged away by a Palestinian man. That certainly matches the behavior of Hamas militants. But who did he work for? He was described as an UNRWA employee. By who? Was this just an Israeli assertion? No. I mean, it was an Israeli assertion, but it was true. He worked for UNRWA. The answer is yes. To quote the Washington Post, his name was Faisal Ali Musallam Nami. And after he was named in confidential Israeli documents last month, the Post found images of Nami online and then used facial recognition software to find a likely match for him in footage of October 7th. The Post found other indications pointing to Nami as the individual in the footage. A Nissan Terrano 2 in the footage appears consistent with the make and the model of the car Nami is pictured with in social media posts, including damaged trim on a rear window. The Post prints his picture. Nami's the same guy dragging away the body of an Israeli on a kibbutz on October 7th. Was he an UNRWA employee? Yes, he was. The Post documents that he worked for UNRWA. They quote a fellow UNRWA employee who liked working with him and called him cheerful and said he was friendly and loved by everyone. And if this sounds like we're talking in the past tense, we were, because by that time, Nami and his family were killed by an Israeli missile strike. Israel had also released phone recordings with someone saying, "We have female hostages. I captured one." And then they lay out who it was saying this. They have his picture. He was an UNRWA teacher. UNRWA did not deny this. On the media does not directly address the UNRWA non-denial. They do, however, leave the impression, or I should say, they directly say there's little to no evidence that Israel put forward. Now, how do I know they left that impression? Their listeners and other journalists tweeted that this was their impression. Here's a tweet from David Moore, who is the co-founder of the investigatory outlet Sludge, described as relentlessly uncovering corruption, an independent reader-supported newsroom. He links to this segment and says, Mehul Srivastava, Financial Times correspondent, says Israel provided no details on accusations against UNRWA workers that led to vital humanitarian funding being cut. He also quotes Senator Chris Van Hollen, quoted later in that report, saying the claim was totally overblown and, quote, evidence was insufficient. Yes, Van Hollen was commenting on not the claim of UNRWA involvement on September 7th, but that related claim that there were 10% of the overall group that was somehow affiliated with Hamas. He said, that's too large a number. He laughed at it. But there are fairly well-documented allegations, not disputed by UNRWA, that their organization had some members who participated in the killing and kidnapping of Israelis on October 7th. And why wouldn't UNRWA have that? It is a large organization. It's educated most Gazans. It operates in Gaza, which is literally controlled by Hamas. If Hamas wants someone to get a job, they get a job. A certain fairly high percentage of Gazans support on some level Hamas. There are 13,000 members of UNRWA. To deny any overlap beggars belief. There is a proper way, I believe, to put the allegations against UNRWA in context. Some do seem to be true and to hold water. So let's acknowledge the evidence where there is evidence and try to set it against the fact and grapple with the fact that in every conflict zone, relief organizations serving a beleaguered population and militants fighting for the liberation, they say, of that population and who share a common enemy will have overlap. What are you going to do about it is the ethical question. On the Media goes much, much further down the road of denying the realities and complexities of how UNRWA operated in part two of their show. Here, Michael Loewinger interviews Lex Tackenberg, who worked for UNRWA as its chief ethics officer for 30 years. Now, he's not an official spokesman for the group. He's better. He's a pro-UNRWA perspective because he's not an official spokesman who might, out of political concern, be constrained. He's a pro-UNRWA spokesperson who takes a complete defense of UNRWA, completely dismisses all critics, and Michael Loewinger seems to appreciate the answers. Here's Loewinger laying the foundation with Tackenberg.
I want to talk about some of the major narratives about UNRWA in Israel. First, let's start with the idea that UNRWA is getting in the way of peace for Israel. This is something that I've seen in the Israeli press and from Israeli officials.
It is peace as defined by these Israeli politicians that you refer to, which is a peace in which Israel succeeds in replacing the indigenous Palestinian population by a Jewish vast majority. The continued existence of UNRWA is seen as standing in the way of that. The right of return does not depend on whether UNRWA continues to exist. Their rights to return to compensation flows from the legality of what happened in 48-49.
Loewinger asks no follow-up about the right of return. Now, you might know this, but I'll tell you, the right of return is the idea that today the descendants of refugees dating back to 1948 should have a right to their former homes and property. I would say that if not every, then 99.something% of Israeli Jews oppose it, because they know that if granted, it would clearly end Israel as a Jewish state. It has no precedent in international law to give the 5 million, in some cases, great-grandchildren of refugees who lost a war of their own making the right to their forefathers' land. Acknowledged. Israel, by the way, probably committed what we would define today as war crimes in that war of 1948, as did the Palestinians, and also acknowledged there is this argument that maybe Israel should not have ever even been granted its slice of land that it was granted by the United Nations that the Palestinians subsequently attacked in 1948. That's not really relevant to the journalistic analysis I'm engaged in. In the same manner, it is not for the host of On the Media to come out for or against a right of return, but I do think they have to explain it. In this segment about warring narratives, what this so-called right practically means for a peace process or a two-state solution is that it would destroy a two-state solution. It has destroyed peace agreements in the past. I believe it's incumbent on a host acting in the best faith to ask, at least ask the guest to grapple with the impossible political situation that would arise if a right of return were to exist. The right of return being the unwavering goal of the relief organization in question. Loewinger does not raise that. In fact, he astoundingly introduces a framework that blew my mind. So take the fact that now the descendants of Palestinian refugees who are living in Egypt, Lebanon, in some cases Jordan, Syria also, they've been denied citizenship in those countries, which are the only countries they've lived in, the only countries many of their parents have ever lived in. Some of their grandparents have never lived in another place, and none of them have citizenship, except in the case of Jordan. This is what Loewinger says, speaking of the reasons that UNRWA was founded.
Some of the neighboring states worried that by permanently hosting these refugees, they would undermine the right of return. And Israel, for demographic reasons, didn't want non-Jews affecting their nascent majority. And so the UN started to scout for alternative paths forward.
Some of the neighboring states worried that by permanently hosting these refugees, they would undermine the right of return. Well, that is certainly a charitable way of being uncharitable. I mean, that's probably true. That was a worry, but it wasn't the primary motivation. Israel was and is the enemy of the neighboring states. It's certainly back then was the enemy of Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan. They'd come under attack in subsequent years from Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, and Palestinian factions operating out of Lebanon. Not absorbing refugees had a political purpose. The autocratic leaders of those countries did not want them. The citizens of those countries did not want them. They were more useful as political chits than as human beings. To take the case of Jordan, which in recent years has done the most to help Palestinian refugees and gives them a version of citizenship. But it wasn't merely taking a pro-right of return stance. For years, Jordan and the Palestinians were engaged in bloody conflict. Ever hear of Black September? You know, the terrorist group that killed Israeli athletes in the Munich Olympics? You know, the Black September, that reference, is September 1970, marking the bloody war between Yasser Arafat and King Hussein of Jordan. The Q&A between Loewinger and Lex Tackenberg could well have been an FAQ that ran on a pro-UNRWA website. But then Loewinger does the journalistic duty of asking Tackenberg to answer his critics, or the version of his critics that OTM chooses to play. You got to hear this, and you will tomorrow, when we discuss this particular episode of On the Media that I believe is a disservice to a full understanding of the issues, but nevertheless, quite frustratingly to me, operates with all the trappings of intellectual honesty. I will also play some parts of a podcast from an Israeli perspective. It's a Times of Israel podcast. It's on UNRWA. And the contrast is amazing. If you love homework, I'll put both of those podcasts, OTM and the Times of Israel podcasts, in the show notes. If you really want to listen to them, go ahead. We will reconfigure to do that tomorrow as I piss off everyone I used to work with in the self-immolation phase of my career. Martyrdom is laudable, I'm hearing these days. Join me, won't you? And that's it for today's show. Working very hard and staying up late, we're just producer Corey Wara, just senior producer Joel Patterson, and, of course, in charge of special projects and concrete intervention is Michelle Pesca. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Thanks for listening.